from Tucson, Arizona. University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program Symposium on Racing. Good morning. Sorry for the delay. Together now, Hammer with us, and we'll talk about his undertaking yesterday after the show with a extensive session. But the keynote speech, really about 15 minutes away, and because we don't miss an opportunity to get some of racing's leaders when we're here, how about the keynote speaker himself, Louis Sella, joining us from Oak Lawn, and good to see you.
Good morning. It's great to be here. It's always fun to be back in Tucson. It's been a couple of years since I've been to the symposium. It hasn't missed a beat. It's growing. It's gone, frankly, back to racing, which is exciting to see. And what an honor it is for me to be here to kick off the 50th annual Global Symposium on Racing.
We don't have a ton of time, so I'll sort of cut to two topics. One, Oak Lawn, of course, related, and we'll let you dote on the new meet. We had three good days to get things started, and everything seems to be in place, you know, for a banner year. And of course, the 3-year-olds a big part of the focus, and you know, the running all the way into May. A little bit about Oak Lawn before we talk some overview about the industry.
Right. Well, we're very excited for kicking off our 121st season. This year we have 110 trainers that have applied for stalls, 20 of which are new outfits coming to Oak Lawn, which is extraordinary. Our backside is full with 1,500 horses. We have a 2-to-1 waiting list to come in. We're giving away about $60 million or more dollars for our 65-day season. So we're going to duplicate what we did last year. It's Mother Nature's hands right now, and we had a great weekend to kick off. So we're very excited.
Is there... And I asked Jason Thursday, Jason Milligan was with us, and we talked about the program kind of in general. Any hidden, not hidden agendas, but any hidden opportunities that...
Well, I think there is, and it ties in great with this program here in Arizona. Pat Pope is a graduate of the RTIP.
That's right.
And he's very creative, and he comes up with, now that we're in December, he comes up with great 2-year-old programs, and then 3, and then older horses. So if you have a promising 2-year-old, you don't have to necessarily race in December before you turn 3, because our big races are stretched out, and you can really time everything from a 2-year-old perspective, a 3-year-old perspective, and an older horse perspective. We're giving away 5 million-plus dollar purse races from the 3-year-old program to older horses. So it's an exciting program for racing.
You know, and before I ask you a more general industry question, I'll make a plug for the Arkansas bred program, which very quietly, in concert with what has transpired with the racing program.
Well, it is. It all started with instant racing, what we call instant racing. Today, it's called historical horse racing. Breeding in Arkansas was in a decline. And when we brought instant racing into the world in 2000, we dedicated funds to not only purses, but to our breeders. And from that start, it has grown. It's grown significantly. And now what is so exciting is you have big-time trainers, Ron Moquette, big-time owners, John Ed Anthony, and others buying into this Arkansas-bred program because the purses are so great. And that's what's fun about Oak Lawn.
You know, and one moment I'll take, the depth of the owner pool that is Arkansas-based is underappreciated on a wider basis
around the
industry. The Leblancs, Frank Fletcher, Steve Landers. You mentioned, obviously,
well,
John,
go
Ed,
on. John Ed. Ed.
The younger
generation was Stanton Fleury.
That's right. That's right.
And you have the Fords that have gone
That's
on
right.
and put so
That's
much
right.
money into racing, and not just Arkansas, nationally. They want to have and have had a national presence. Steve Landers, who's on our racing commission, Alex Leblanc, who's chairman of our racing commission, they're leaders in the industry, and frankly, they put their money where their mouth is. They said, look, if it's good for Arkansas, it's going to be good for New York, Kentucky, Florida, and California, and all parts in between.
Louis Sella is with us, who just a few minutes is going to go into the Grand Ballroom and offer the opening remarks as the keynote speaker for the symposium. And Louis, talk a little bit about your view of where the industry is right now, and the challenges that you think are most, I won't say easily addressed, because nothing is easily addressed. Maybe even preface your remarks today.
That's a wonderful segue, because that's exactly what I'm talking about in about 5 minutes. I think that Arkansas has shown by example that if the interested parties get together, check their egos at the table, they can solve problems. It's all doable. When we talk about Arkansas, we're a small state with a small population base in the middle of the Bible Belt, surrounded by over 100 casinos. Think about that. No other state in the country has that. And when we can sit around a table and solve the problem and have purses six times higher than they were 20 years ago, when you look at the national average, it's actually declined if you increase inflation. When you look at Arkansas and Oakland that started the first interstate merge pool simulcast, why Arkansas? When we created instant racing, now historical horse racing, why Arkansas? When we created Oakland Anywhere and the show bet bonus and so many things that are national leaders, why Arkansas? And I think the underpinning of that is we get along with everyone. We check. We don't have to agree on everything, but we get along. We understand the importance of sitting around the table and solving the problem, and that's the bottom line.
Well, that that kind of thinking goes a long way, and certainly having family ownership, which is the legacy, of your family, essentially. I mean, there's so few examples of this.
That's right. In fact, I'm representing the fourth generation, and we are the oldest family in American sports franchise that has the same common ownership. Back in the early 90s, we overpaid purses by millions of dollars, and right when we thought we were going, frankly, out of business, we overpaid purses, which made no sense in the world. A publicly traded company couldn't do that and would not do that. We've never asked for that overpayment back. A public company, senior management would be fired if they didn't do that. So, yes, there are a number of advantages we have with being privately owned, for sure.
Well, Oaklawn, the profile and the presence in the industry just has grown. I mean, in the time that that I've become a serious player over the last 25-30 years, I mean, it always seemed like kind of a regional seasonal meet, and its presence just has become part of really a national scale, and that's that is thanks to vision, father and you.
It started with Dad, and frankly, back in the early 70s, Hot Springs has been known for a wonderful, rich history of casino gambling, even though it was never legal. And the governor finally threw it out in the late 60s. Well, that's when Oakland started to take off.
Yeah.
And Dad had a vision, and I'm just fortunate enough to carry on that vision to now we are Oakland Racing Casino Resort with a 200-room hotel, Forbes-rated hotel, Forbes-rated restaurants, a four-star spa, with the best thoroughbred racing in the country. So it's very exciting.
Well, it's always tremendous to see you. Look, in fact, I booked some flights early this morning. Looks like a Rebel weekend we'll be in, and do a little combination Risen Star Rebel, which is kind of my favorite part of the schedule. And Louis Sella, always a pleasure. Continued success, and looking forward to the reception you get this morning.
Thank you so much.
Louis Sella from Oaklawn, of course, and always a pleasure. Somebody that has so effectively impacted the game. And Rick, you spotted him coming, onto the floor here.
He's hard to miss, and you can tell just the few minutes that you got to talk with him, his enthusiasm is unbridled, and Dick, you're going to go in and report? Report on the speech? But anyway, you mentioned the family-owned thing. That is one of the most missed things in the industry right now. They want to get something done. They don't have to go, call upstairs. He is upstairs, right?
Yeah.
They get it done.
You spent time. You knew.
Absolutely. And, what you just heard in the last 5 minutes is that's how he is, a very enthusiastic, hires good people and lets them do their thing. And, who'd have thought, like you said, 15, 20 years ago, that it would be Oaklawn Park would be the one that, lead the industry into the HHR time that we're having in the boom. And anyone that hasn't been, I was just telling them, I said, I wish I was, kind of still there, but I enjoyed the 2.5 month meet. They've stretched out to December to Derby weekend. And the reason they did that was to take advantage of, obviously, the new hotel he mentioned and the casino. And if you haven't been there in the last 3, 4, 5 years, we just have someone sitting down that's been to Oaklawn Park many, many times.
It's his home track.
And run a lot of horses. Marshall Graham, it's just always a pleasure to see you. We just had Mr. Sellis sitting there, and we were just kind of going over there.
Well, I was at his track on Friday. I went for opening day and had a horse in the Trails Beginning. I've always loved the Trails End. I've won it 3 times. And so, they start a race called the Trails Beginning, a starter 10. I was going to play it. So I was there for opening day, and there were 13,000 people there. It was a pretty active crowd for a cold day, a cold December day in Hot Springs, but I loved it. I went from there to Dallas and played in a contest at Lone Star, then flew out here to Tucson to join y'all.
We wouldn't expect anything else. Now, I noticed that race that Tommy Vanberg had 2 in, because that's like he loves that stuff.
Yes.
Who won the race? I missed it.
Gennaro Garcia horse named Bright Spark.
Okay.
That both Vanberg and I... We both had passed on that horse when it ran for Indiana last time for 7,500 because we thought there were too many red flags. So it was a bitter pill to swallow, both losing to that horse for both of us. Because Vanberg and I had this rivalry in the Trails End. He beat me by a nose last year, but I was live in the pick five. Probably no one wants to hear my sob story. But I was live in the pick five to my horse and Vanberg's 2 horses for between 20 and 55 grand on a $96 ticket. And then I get beat by the horse that I could have claimed his last start and just, again, never did. So Garcia beat us, and that horse's Trails ineligible. Probably the one to beat if anyone's making early book on my favorite race of the year.
That's
so great. It's funny because with Mr. Sella, I threw in the Arkansas Bred program and how it very quietly is ratcheting up. Clinton Stewart managing that one stallion station. And I then talked about the concentration of top owners, Marshall. And I was about to include you, being adjacent, of course, in Memphis, because it's appropriate, and your team, but it's just a signal that its presence is raised and it's been elevated, I think on a widespread basis, and that, to be honest, that comes at a time where turf racing, has become as proliferated as options and condition book standards, and yet there's no turf course, so it kind of flies in the face of a lot of the betting trends that we've seen over the last 15 years, let's say.
Well, Marshall, a guy such player as you, who plays in tournaments, and you're a tournament player and a bigger player. Races that are run, like, let's face it, Oaklawn runs 3/4 on the dirt, 1 mile on the dirt, 1 1/16 on the dirt. Does that help you evaluate races better because you have so much data on the different kinds of races?
Yes, I think it, in terms of even making speed figures or looking at races and identifying bias, the fact that you have 3 distances and it's all on one surface makes everything more straightforward. I also would think for anyone, trying to fill a race, the fact that, trainers only have three choices, right? So they don't have to worry about, well, my horse is a 7/8 horse, got to wait for those spots. So as an owner, it's also easy because, you know, you don't have to sort of, you know, you don't have to wait for your trainer to pick the perfect spot, right? So, you know, I think that's, I often think we overcomplicate things.
Well, you hit that right on the head. People said, you know, as a race executor myself, my job is to make the trainer not have to think about where I'm going to go. I give them less opportunity, so they're going to go to A. If you give them A, B, and C, they'll pick C every time because they can wait and wait and wait. But if there's no other place to go, it's it. People say, well, are they going to put a turf course in? Why would they put a turf course in?
Crazy.
You couldn't race there until maybe end of March, so you'd have a bunch of horses standing there not racing. So every horse that goes to Oakland, when they go there, they know this is what I'm doing. I'm running on dirt, so why would I bring any of the horses that well, fit?
And the one thing people don't realize is since horses race less, you know, stall space becomes at a premium, right? Because so, you know, if they had a turf course and suddenly got turf horses, that's taking stalls away from horses who might run. And so it's, you know, and they,
exactly.
You know, it's not
good
like...
Point. So that's why it's perfect the way it is.
Exactly.
Let's get this straight. Turfway Park averages 10 plus a race, yeah. One surface. Kentucky Downs, one surface. Oakland, one surface. Probably 1, 2, 3 in a field size in the country because, just as you said, less choice. The horses are there, run at for what you offer. So,
well, I also think from a handicapping perspective, you know, having one surface makes it easier. I think that, like, even Turfway, they're all, you know, they're running on synth the whole meet. And so as that form gets developed, it's easier to see. When you have horses jumping back and forth, because, you know, synth is not turf and synth is not dirt. It's somewhere in between. And so, and often we have horses that are good synth horses that aren't necessarily good at turf or dirt, right? So it's its own unique self. I think it's a tricky thing in racing is we have more and more choices for distances, more and more choices for conditions, more and more choices for surface, just trying to get the right races to go,
right,
and creating a bettable product. So, you know, at Oaklawn and Turfway, they're both specializing. They're getting big fields. As a horse player, I'm going to get to play what I want to play. So I really enjoy it. I mean, and the other thing about Oaklawn is there are a lot of trainers coming from different small tracks. You know, it to me, it's a mini Saratoga, right? It's you know, poor man's Saratoga, but I love it.
Marshall, tomorrow you're involved in the Mark Kaufman workshop. How do we keep racing relevant in the evolving wagering landscape? And of course, wagering technology and the wagering issues at large is your wheelhouse. You know, some. Maybe preface a little bit your thoughts about you know, what will be discussed tomorrow, and then I won't say that that the CAW topic has quieted per se, but it does feel as if there's a better understanding among the core horse players of what we're dealing with, and that there, you know, there's been some inroads in terms of presentation of projected odds. I mean, this is something you've talked about for ages. Some thoughts about you know, tomorrow and the topic at large.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're right. The fact that more horse players understand what's going on has really helped. I still think, you know, it's still very worrisome, the odds drops we're seeing in many ways. I've looked at some of the data. The last 12 months has been worse, right? Things are,
yep,
potentially getting worse. And so, you know, I think one thing that I'll certainly bring up is, as we try to attract this new breed of better and try to make them horse players, is we've got to figure out a way to stabilize our odds. And I, you know, I'm now gone to the extremes of, I'd love to see all batch betting removed from visible pools when plays show exact a double in the last couple minutes, so that we don't see these big movements.
What would happen if we just shut betting down at post time? What would happen? What would be
well,
the reaction?
I mean, we would still have money movements, but it would at least clear up. So we still have big odds drops, but it
exactly.
would clear up any misperceptions about anyone, you know, anyone, any nefarious
betting after
nature,
the
yes,
after exactly. the belt. Because that's the point to me, for me, is I don't, if my horse went from 8 to 2, but it was frozen at 2, and I made my bet, I know I'm getting 2. The problem is I'm betting at 8, and then at, you know, the quarter pole, it flashes down to 6 and then 4. I would rather see that movement before the gates open, so I know what I'm getting. And that's all I'm asking is let me know what I'm getting.
I mean, how about, I mean, they could do, I mean, again, I don't know the tow technology, but what about stopping betting at post time for the visible pools, win, place, show, exact a double, for all off-track participants, the ones waiting in line on the track, they can still make their bets, right? They're not going to move the odds.
Sure.
But then I don't have a problem with that at all. I think that might help. I would even like to get rid of the batch betting for in those pools at 2 minutes to post, right? I don't, if people batch bet in the trifecta, pick six, whatever, right? But in the ones that, that create those big movements, yes, which are then, you know, pushing newbies out of the game, you know, anyone coming from betting sports. I mean, I always think of a parallel as suppose you're betting the Eagles game and you think you're getting minus seven. It turns out you get minus 4.5, right? I mean,
I said that in the presentation yesterday. I said, imagine you got seven on your ticket at the kickoff, the ball's in the air and it switched to four. Yeah. Well, you know what happened? The place would go nuts.
Yes.
And guess what? The next game, it would be fixed. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. We know the problem. We just need to fix it.
The pari-mutuel system is a wonderful system, right? It allows the house to basically not have to take a side.
Yes.
Right? But it was never really meant to be, not manipulate's the wrong word, but, you know, it was never meant for bets to come in the last minute like they are. Yeah. Right? And so if we can clear up the visible pools, I think it would really help. I don't want to be totally negative. There's so much opportunity here with racing's position as a gambling prospect. In this era where, you know, betting is legal and accepted and understood and popularized. You watch any sporting event now, they talk about betting. And so as it's become more socially accepted and as more people are doing it, you know, the great thing about horse races is we run, you know, dozens of races a day. The races are over in 72 seconds, so it really fits a short attention span. Right, and it's you know, you bet on sports. It's 3.5 hours of getting your teeth pulled. I mean, I can't even fathom like betting basketball because the last minute you could be up by three and suddenly you're up by 10. Right, so I just I don't sports betting. It's not really my thing. And I like a horse race. We're over in 72 seconds, right? And boom, and I can. So for,
and then there's another one.
Yes.
Who was it that is it Dave Hill that somebody explained or presented betting a football game as a essentially a 3.5 hour wait for a photo.
Yeah.
To come in. It's
true.
I forget who made that analogy.
And there are times, and I don't bet a whole lot. Of course, in California, you know, quote, can't bet. But many times I'll do it. I'll just be a scorecard guy. Just let me see the score at the end of the game. I hate to say that because, like you say, I get crazy sometimes during the game, and it gets down to the end. I just show me the score. Did I win or did I lose? I'll watch the replay later. But you're 100% right about that. When you're kind of bred to be betting horses, and we have our whole lives, that game is like, come on, just give me the results, will you? Right?
Yeah. No. And again, so like I feel like if we can stabilize our odds movements, or if there's even, you know, like I would have long ago gone to, you know, I would have gone to an exchange wagering version of the wind pool, right? Because I think the teams would love that. I think players would love that. And it's something that the industry could control. You know, I don't know that we'd ever get there. I would like to see what fixed odds in racing would be. I'm a little bit concerned about it. I don't know enough about it. I'm willing to give anything a chance now. I haven't made up my mind about that. I don't know if that'll be part of our topic tomorrow.
So your hybrid suggestion about cutting off some pools and not others is that's unique to. I've never heard anyone else come up with that. But that's something that you should.
Well, I wouldn't even cut it off. I would just get rid of the batch betting part of it. If you got rid of the batch betting part of it, and people have to basically hand put in their exact as
I see
bets.
What you're saying, and explain what the batch what. Batch
oh, the fact
is.
That the teams or you know the teams or anyone else. I mean, I could file. You could file upload with any of your ADWs, you know, 1,000 exacta combinations, right? And those
like in an instant.
So that's what the teams are doing. They're betting, you know, this across all pools, and they're using the public's information to make their bets, and they're uploading thousands of bets a second at the last minute, right? And so, you know, in the superfecta, it means they may be uploading, you know, 2,500 different superfecta combinations, and 2,500 may just be $250, but they're doing it really efficiently. Now, the fact that they changed the super effective payouts, right, that's behind a closed door because no one sees those. But when they move the exacta pool from $70 to $35, right, that ultimately, you know, people think that something's crooked going on, or they don't necessarily recognize that $70 is something they were never going to get, or 8-to-1 was something they were never going to get. And as Steve brought up earlier, we have done a better job, you know, with double probables, with some of these projected odds, at least helping people see where the odds are going to go. But again, to me, this is one of the biggest impediments, right, that we have right now.
Anecdotally, and actually, I mentioned Dave Hill's name. Did you read his piece from Rolling Stone?
I have not.
It'd be very interesting to get your impression, because he, in the course of the year-long, Todd Pletcher joining us next, in the course of his year-long research for the piece on sports betting, he sees the bloom off the rose already, and that the sports betting companies are already turning the page and looking ahead to what's next for them, which is online casino, essentially. But there's been a epiphany amongst the, and I personally have kind of had this feeling for years leading up to, you know, the proliferation of sports betting. Everybody that, you know, we grew up thinking, oh, if I could only, if I only didn't have to go to Vegas to, you know, to make a bet, I could do great, I could kill it. And everybody suddenly has realized that not only are they not going to kill it, but if they show that they've actually got an aptitude, they're going to get shut off. Yeah. And that's something that doesn't exist in our game. And we should be advertising to those frustrated sports bettors that your money's welcome here, and the depth of your bankroll is not going to be limited. And they're killing themselves, the sports betting companies. And we should be scooping those guys up and show them you've got a fighting chance here. You're not betting against an edge in a house. I mean, granted, the cost structure is tough to beat, but you got a fighting chance.
Oh, I totally agree. I think, again, that's the wonderful nature of the pari-mutuel system. And if we can fix some of these issues, and I think they're fixable. You know, we have a great game where players can win, right? I mean, but it shouldn't be just, you know, the way we have it set up to where, you know, the pricing is so dramatically different for certain players than others, and where so few players win. I'd love to see just a more level playing field, and I think there are ways that we can get that done, right? And the frustration in odds movements works both directions. Not only is it bad when 8-to-1 horse goes to 4-to-1, right? It's bad when a 4-to-1 horse goes to 8-to-1 because people might have bet that horse at 8-to-1, right? They're not betting at 4-to-1, so we have lost handle there. So there are things that we can do that I think can improve what we do, and again, we're moving in the right direction.
You know, as a contest player, I mean, that's got to be dramatic to get the end of a contest.
Oh, yeah,
I
mean, that's a nightmare.
There's just so many instances, and I think I was saying the other day in the thing, our game, when the pendulum swings, we don't swing here. We wait till it goes all the way to the top, till we change it, and then comes back down. So I think the pendulum is at that spot where it's time to make the change, and there's been enough groundswell to support, and guys like you, respected in the game and have the ideas that people are going to listen to you, and I think we got to get this done.
Yeah, let's hope so. I've been coming here for now 10 years. I think I've said the same thing every year.
That's all right.
Well, so we'll see. I'm going to keep banging the drum. But
the key is when you walk out the door here, it's got to keep continue. That's what happens at these things. We sit here, we have a great time, we love a beer, and then we go home, and then we'll see you next year. The talk needs to continue outside the doors here, and, you know, in smaller groups, and get this stuff done. And you're one of the guys that get it done.
Well, I appreciate y'all having me on, and it's a great symposium. I always love being out in Tucson.
How about a picture with Todd Pletcher? Do you have a picture with Todd?
I don't.
There you go.
He doesn't realize it yet, but I've got a horse that's going to go with him. I own a horse with Rapoli that I bred, and we stayed in with.
Very
so
fun.
I'm excited.
Do you know Marshall, Todd? Marshall Graham, Todd Pletcher.
Nice, there you go.
Tracy Pletcher.
I'm sending you that article. I'm gonna send it to you.
Send me the picture too.
Of course.
That's gonna cost.
No. So ridiculous. Unbelievable. Marshall, thank you.
Thank you.
Always fabulous. Marshall, tomorrow today, one of a segment that was so good a couple of years ago, they're doing it again. Fletcher and Baffert. Good morning.
Morning.
You're just Fletcher.
Yep. Bob's upstairs.
Is he arriving to the breakfast just like he gets to the barn?
You know what? I'm going to throw the flag on that.
Yeah. All right.
I go out and I've been with Bob a long time and Todd that frequently. Every time I go to the race to the track in the morning, I'm there at 5:36 and I walk up around. He's there. He's there in his golf cart. I got to throw the flag on that. He maybe shows up once in a while, a little bit later, but he's up there.
In passing over the years, we've talked about your experience here at the University of Arizona as a student. Let's start with that before we talk about action on the Oval and how you discovered the university and what got you here?
So actually, it was a little bit odd how it started. I was wanting to go to college, but I knew what I wanted to do as far as a career, and sort of made sense to try to tie the two together the best you could. And there's not really a college for training horses. But my dad was racing at Louisiana Downs. Pat Pope was the racing secretary. Pat Pope was a graduate University of Arizona, and he said, you got to go out there. Just do me a favor, go out there and visit the campus, and if you don't like it, I'd be shocked. And so flew out with my dad in December, my senior year of high school, and kind of toured the campus, and, the weather was awesome, and I didn't have anywhere else that I really was interested in going, and so I said, if I'm going to be in the industry, I might as well go to college somewhere where at least they have some courses that are, gonna be useful. And turned out to be the case because, I grew up on the backside more or less. My dad being a trainer, I was familiar with everything on the backside, but, the paramutual front side was I learned a lot of things here that I wasn't aware of.
That's interesting too, and Hammer, you could speak to it because there is the paths. There's the animal path, and there's the business path, and sometimes there's crossover. And I know, for instance, Mitch Gerson worked for you for a little bit, and now he ended up working for Equibase as a chart caller. So they kind of go back and forth.
Just talk about the school in itself. Todd came in literally with a plan. He knew what he wanted to do. He came to the school as a means to an end. I came here a little bit later. I think I was 26 when I came. I always wanted to get in the game. I didn't have any ties. I said, found an Iden racing form. I said, well, maybe we'll try this thing out. And this was like, where am I? This is unbelievable. This is great. I'm around a bunch of people to race. When I got out, I had no idea what I was going to do and ended up at Golden Gate Fields. And then I remember when I was going to, when I got shipped to Monmouth Park, and Todd's training for Wayne, assistant trainer for Wayne, who shipped down to Monmouth and whatever. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, this is really cool. I mean, but two opposite ends of coming to school here, and this just goes to show that if you have any interest at all, whether you have a plan or you don't have a plan, this is where you want to come if you want to be involved in that sport at any facet of it, right, Todd?
I think when you look back, going back to even before us, the number of people who have been placed into good positions from this program is phenomenal. And I'm really proud of the fact that you look around and see a lot of top level management people in the horse industry, in the racing industry, are graduates of the U of A and the racetrack industry program.
I think when we, or at least I know when we got out to the world, we had always had to say, you're one of those. Oh, you're one of those people. And so it was kind of like a little jealousy involved. And now at this point, the industry is just overwhelmed with us, that it's great for the students. We met some students yesterday and intermingled with them and said, take advantage of this family that is U of A. Yep. And It's like anywhere. It's who you know. And there's people at all levels that you go. I mean, I run into people that didn't even know what school here. Oh, I mean, oh, you went to U of A. Oh, so did I. There's so many. So it's just a great great launching pad.
Well, there's a job. One thing that in terms of placement, there's a job in the industry for every single student that comes out of here. I mean, that having that is a 99 point something percent placement rate. I mean, there's something. I mean, you'll get a job in the industry. So it's a proving ground. It's a training ground. It's got it all. Then you went out into the world and made your way to Hall of Fame. Talk a little bit about the recent performances, and that included you right on cue, you win a Cigar Mile with Locked, and boy, talk about planning a comeback. It couldn't have gone better.
No, it really couldn't have, and you know, it was frustrating the beginning of the year because, you know, we felt like him and Fierceness were both legitimate Derby contenders, and to get sidetracked, and you know, it's just unfortunate timing. We did everything right by the horse and gave him plenty of time, and so coming back, trying to figure out, okay, you know, what do you do now with a horse that you know, you're pretty sure is best at two turns. Late in the year, options are thinning, not in time for the Breeders' Cup. So we just felt like getting a start into him. Turns out we did that in a 7-furlong allowance race at Aqueduct, that he came back and ran a really, really good race and showed more tactical speed than he had in some of his other races. And so that kind of got us started thinking, you know, like, you know, Cigar Mile, the way he ran in this, in, you know, over this track going 7 furlongs might be, you know, a good target. And so, yeah, it was good to see him step up, win a big race like that, be a Grade 1 winner too now. And my eyes, a Grade 1 winner at 3, even though Cigar Mile was downgraded a little bit, but that's a separate issue. So, you know, to beat older horses and now, you know, hopefully onto the Pegasus or Saudi or both or who knows what, but, you know, we'll get with the group and come up with a game plan after we get him down to Florida. And but it's great to have him back.
And it's interesting, you mentioned two of the three, Mindframe as well as Locked, and then there's the Fierceness portion. Give everybody the specifics of the elective surgery. I assumed a chip, or you know, what went on, and some thoughts about you know, how precarious this is.
Yeah, so you know, Fierceness came into us in April of his 2-year-old year, and he never left the barn. He after he won the Breeders' Cup at Santa Anita, he went straight to Palm Beach Downs and started gearing up for the Holy Bull and the Florida Derby and et cetera. So we felt like, you know, big decision to be made after running second in the Classic, running a huge race, that, you know, we needed to do a physical to make sure everything checked out. And, you know, Mike had an important decision to make to keep him in training at 4, which, you know, when you look at it economically, it's not necessarily the right decision, but that's not why Mike made the decision to run him. So we wanted to check him out. had a minor issue in a hind leg that was going to heal fine with 60 days off, but by doing a possible surgery, we maybe lessen that time to 45 days. And we got a couple of different opinions. Some guys said, you know, I'd leave it alone. I wouldn't touch it. Some guys said, you know, as an insurance package policy, go ahead and clean it up. And so we wanted to make sure we got it right, and we elected to go ahead and do the surgery to accelerate the process a little bit. You know, 2 weeks doesn't seem like a lot, but sometimes as a trainer, when you're trying to get ready and make a prep race before the Met Mile or something, it could make a difference. So, so, you know, we talked it through and felt like the right thing was to go ahead and do the surgery, and glad we did it. Now we'll hopefully get him back, and the game plan has been the races we really want to be ready for: the Met Mile, the Whitney, Breeders' Cup Classic, and then we're going to have to fill in a couple of gaps there with you know, a prep race coming back and something in between, maybe the Whitney and the Classic.
It reflect on the campaign and the season, because it was a very interesting. The 3-year-old season it overall has been fascinating this year, and you know the way in which certain horses, most notably Sierra Leone and Fierceness, both ended up, you know, kind of validating the confidence that the respective outfits had in them and that horse players and fans had in them with, you know, with signature wins. It's funny. Everybody is so critical of 3-year-olds, you know, leading up to and through the Triple Crown season, and then you get to the end of the year and you realize this is a really good group of 3-year-olds. Wasn't this really kind of fun? Talk about, you know, validating the expectations after some fishtailing for Fierceness through the first half of the year.
Yeah, I've always said that, with to your point, that you really can't evaluate 3-year-old crops until the fall of the year. And I think in the fall of the year, with 3-year-olds finishing first, second, and third in the Breeders' Cup Classic, it's all you need to know about the strength of this 3-year-old crop. But, you know, look, I think Fierceness has been a little bit unfairly judged as being an in-and-out horse and every other racehorse. If you watch the Holy Bull, if you think that any horse could have won with the trip he got that day, you're asking a lot. I mean, to me, the race was over in the first 100 yards. And so, you know, that third place finish was not that bad. Florida Derby was as good as any horse ran all year. Maybe, arguably, the strongest performance of any 3-year-old of the year. The Kentucky Derby, we just got that trip that a lot of times doesn't work in any race, but especially in that race when you're 3-4 wide the whole way and you're prompting a really fast pace going a mile and a quarter at Churchill. And, you know, Mystic Dan's the only horse that was part of the pace that was still around, and he got a very different trip. He was inside, tucked away, saving ground, perfect split, just at the right moment. And so, you know, it didn't work out for Fierceness that day under those, in that setting. And then, you know, after that, I don't know how much more consistent he could have been. You know, he beats Sierra Leone in the Jim Dandy, he beats Sierra Leone in the Travers, beats likely horse of the year in the Travers, and then comes back, prompts a 44-4 pace in the Breeders' Cup Classic, and still hanging around, fighting in the ends. You know, to me, that any questions about his consistency or you know, abilities, is he answered all those questions in a big way.
Beyond Fierceness, do you want to speculate on the 3-year-old champion?
You know, from what I can see, I think it's really close. It's really close. And, you know, Sierra Leone was consistent in that he was on the board pretty much every time, but, you know, he had the losing streak from the Kentucky Derby, the Jim Dandy, the Travers, and you know, to beat him twice was significant. And I do think there, you know, is a difference between when it's head-to-head and you can say, okay, Sierra Leone finished ahead of Fierceness in the Kentucky Derby. That's fair, but he didn't win the Kentucky Derby. So, you know, it's a loss for both horses. And, you know, but look, that's me looking at it from my side. Like I said, I think the Florida Derby was a race, if you look back, incredible performance. It's very close. And I think you can make an argument for both horses. I do think for a losing effort, his Classic was about as good as a horse can run while not winning. And I've had a lot of people reach out to me and say, you ran, you know, incredible. Unfortunately, it wasn't the right setup. The Japanese horse shows up, puts blinkers on, goes really fast. It for Del Mar, we thought it was a track that might play in our favor. And just the way it set up, it obviously set up, you know, for a closer. But still really proud of his effort that day.
There's a lot in kind of putting, you know, a bow on the year for the barn. A couple of couple of notes. Certainly got to think that it was a very good year for the older horses, for the handicap side of things, very quietly with a couple of projects that panned out. I mean, Croupy, the satisfaction in Croupy's wins has got to be significant in the barn for obvious reasons. By being named, after JJ. And then, of course, Tappet Trice was another success story. There's three-year-olds under the radar that were kind of late developers that are going to be important horses as we turn the corner to 2025. Illuminaire, right, for Centennial, and Mindframe. Talk about the ones that were out of the spotlight, out of the glare of the sophomore season.
Yeah, and our goal every year with the Colts are trying to make some stallion prospects, and so. I think we were able to achieve that with quite a few, a couple of them you mentioned, with Tappet Trice going to Gainesway after, his Monmouth Cup and Woodward wins, and then Charge It going to Gainesway also. I think he's kind of a, I wouldn't call him a sleeper because he's in some ways a household name, but big, strong, good-looking horse, won the Dwyer by 23 lengths. One of the strongest bottom sides in American racing. I think he has a big chance and a bright future going to Claiborne. So
that's right about it.
Those were key. But we're excited obviously about Locked coming back, Fierceness coming back, Mindframe coming back. Those are I think horses that all have potential to be at the head of the 4-year-old crop, older horse division.
The two Centennials, Illuminaire and Antiquarian.
Antiquarian's coming back next week. They Don Little and Dr. Carr told me looks phenomenal, doing really well. So Peter Pan winner last year, horse that certainly you could see getting better as he gets older. Illuminaire's 3-for-4 now, coming off a pretty fast allowance race. He'll go in the Mr. Prospector next. So yeah, we're excited about those. Now we just need some of these 2-year-olds turning 3 to step up.
Do you want to address? There's been a bunch of maiden winners over the last couple of months that either came to hand late, but talk a little bit. I got to assume that one of the real disappointments of Breeders' Cup was Menti. The opportunity for him, I thought, to stretch out. I thought he had a chance to wire that juvenile. If you talk a little bit about the 2-year-old's Noble Confessor went right and Gate to Wire.
Yeah, I mean, I think to be frank, it's been a little bit of a disappointing 2-year-old crop. I think I agree. I thought Menti stretching out to the mile was perfect for him, and. He simply didn't fire it all that day. Gate to Wire, we were concerned 5 furlongs might be a little too sharp for him, and I think that turned out to be the case. Noble Confessor, I thought, ran sneaky good, was closing well, galloped out in front. I think he could be a really nice 3-year-old on the turf horse next summer when these races stretch out and they go 1 3/16 to 1 3/8. I think that's going to be right in his sweet spot.
Well, and you had Grand Sonata that jumped up and
yeah, I mean we had the great win with him at Kentucky Downs, yeah. and he's been a consistent horse that he just missed in the United Nations, lost a tough head bob that day, but he's been a trooper for a while and cool horse to have in the barn, and just he's probably just a tick below the top European horses, so we're going to probably try him back in the Fort Lauderdale, shorten him up a little bit with the idea, if that goes well, we'll take a shot at the Pegasus turf.
And on the topic of Whisper Hill, of Vandy Pope, very quietly, for all of the frankly snickering that went on as she was spending so freely, you and her other trainers have all started to punch the tickets, and her long-term play is coming to fruition in a lot of directions in virtually all the areas that you know that she's involved with, 3-year-olds and you talk about Tappet Trice and you know, a horse like this that is a horse, right? He's not a gelding Grand Sonata.
Yeah, we had Leslie's Rose win the Ashland early in the year, Grade 1 win for her, you know, off a expensive yearling purchase. I think, like you said, you're starting to see her investment, her dedication, you know, building a broodmare band is starting to pay dividends, and don't sleep on what they're doing there.
The overall what direction I wanted to ask you and it flittered. The industry topics at large.
I mean, where do you want to start?
Can I segue into it just a little bit?
Yeah, go ahead.
I could segue into a little bit of your career. You mentioned earlier that you went to work for Wayne. I mean, obviously, one of the Change the Game all-time great trainers. And he's known for his children, say, off into the woods as came into the game like you have. And the trainers that worked under him that went on to, you know, Kieran, you know, Mark Hennig, George, right?
Yep.
Yeah, George Weaver, Mike Maker, numerous trainers that came out and have made names. Now you're starting to have some of your assistants, Mike McCarthy and Jonathan.
Yeah, I Thomas, think last Thanksgiving week, when Amelia Green had her first runner that won, I looked at it, and I think during that week span, seven different former assistants won a race that week.
Wow.
So it was
pretty cool, right? Yeah, so yeah. I mean, that just says something about the system and, you know, the professionalism.
Yeah, that's one thing you know that I've been proud of. Not only have those guys and girls went on to do well, but I think they all represent the game the right way. You know, they're professional, they work hard and do the right thing, and so, you know, we're proud of their success, but also proud of the way they handle themselves in the sport.
And I can say on my end, you know, of talking to trainers and having to deal with situations and, you know, calling up for races and nominations, when you make one of those phone calls, what I always appreciated was the answer you get is the answer. You know, if you say you're going to show up at you're going to be in Malibu on, you know, you're going to be there unless some unforeseen happens. And not a wishy-washy.
Right.
If you don't know, you don't know. Maybe this, maybe that. Call me next week. Guess when they call you next week, you're going to answer the phone, and you're going to get an answer. And you can tell a lot about little situations like that. The smallest thing, the stall application. Always in on time, always neat, always, you know, no phony horses on there. It's made up stuff. And you can trust it. I mean, believe it. That's a whole different deal. But starts at the little things and then show how the big things end up and the success that you've had and that you learned and not only learned but were able to pass on, I think is a good testament.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that was the one thing that Wayne and Jeff always emphasized was, you know, attention to detail and the little things spill over to the big things. Yeah. And, you know, so, I mean, if you approach it that way and try to cover every angle and dot every I and cross every T, you know, I mean, it might sometimes feel like it's not working, but if you do it consistently, hopefully it is.
In terms of the I dotting and T crossing, because I have not seen any comment from you overall. We did talk about it, I think, maybe, you know, at the beginning or at some point during the year. But what's your impression of where we are with the HISA administration, with the regulatory vets? I frankly, at the top of my mind, I can't think of any horses of yours that have been, you know, that have been late scratches or gate scratches, etc.
You ought to have a shorter memory than I do because the Forte one still hurts pretty bad.
Well, there you go. There's an example.
So, first of all, I've been supportive of HISA, you know, and I've tried to, currently on the Horseman's Advisory Group, subcommittee with prohibitive and banned substances. I think the overall approach is something that the game needed. But, of course, with any new entity, they're going to make mistakes. And I think some of the summary suspensions were premature and harsh and not well thought out. And, you know, so it's a growing pain, and that's easy for me to say because, fortunately, I haven't been involved in one of these potentially life-changing, you know, situations like George Weaver dealt with and, you know, some other guys are currently dealing with. So, you know, I think they've seen that. They're now correcting it, but I wish that, you know, we could have rolled it out a little more softly than we did and could have saved some, you know, a lot of headache and heartache for a lot of people. But, you know, I think you make mistakes and you move forward. And I think, you know, if it's able to maintain its constitutional status and all that, which I don't think is a slam dunk myself. I'm not an attorney by any means, but I think that's going to be very, very interesting. And so I think if that goes through and they're set up for good, then, you know, I think that's going to help and propel some forward momentum. And if it doesn't happen, I think that's going to be really interesting if we go back to the states and the gaming commissions who, you know, frankly are pretty incompetent at a lot of levels.
Has the authorities' presence and the needs of and the changes to regulations has it impacted your operation, or in what ways has it impacted it?
Well, I mean, I think it's impacted everyone in the industry. I think, you know, the few areas that are most obvious are just, you know, the amount of paperwork and, you know, essentially I need basically a HISA representative, you know, on my staff that is making sure we're in compliance with...
Compliance officer.
Yeah, compliance officer. And, you know, the part I have a little bit of an issue is with some of the restrictions on when you can breeze horses and, you know, if you have an intra-articular injection and you can't breeze for 7 days and you know it's going to rain and you can't move that work forward one day, which is in the best interest of the horse, in my opinion. You know, there's some areas like that where... You know, you're kind of taking some common sense and some horsemanship out of the equation and, you know, just to be constantly just counting days and making sure you're not one day premature, which I think almost a large percentage of those violations are 24-hour errors on trainers, you know, part that just are trying to do the right thing by the horse and move a breeze forward a day and you're getting fined for it.
So we came yesterday, part of discussion that I led with Haisu and Hai Wu in the room had to do with just what Todd said, common sense. There's a couple things. Is this guy trying to skirt a rule? Well, that's one thing. But when weather kicks in, and we saw a little bit of a crack in that there's a new 150-day rule coming up where if you haven't raced for 150 days, you're going to get a warning. You have to, you know, get the horse checked and all that. And that's good for 30 days, that check. And I was talking to Dr. Silverman from HISA, and she said, well, you know, we're going to go a little easy because this is something that now you have to put in. You as a trainer have to put in your portal. Instead of turning in paperwork, you physically have to go into the portal and check the boxes that you did your deal. So you get 30 days for the horse to run. So she says, well, you know, and let's say that we're going to be a little bit lean. The horse, let's say he's entered in a turf race and it rains and it comes off and the race comes back and it's, you know, 32 or 33 days. You know, we're going to look into done. And I saw stop right there and I said, whoa. I said, this is what we're looking for. Just some common sense.
Yeah.
Give the trainer, you know, that's not trying to take advantage of anything. He's following the rule. And for circumstances beyond your control, a day here, a day there. Let's take some certain times, let's take it case by case. And
right.
In that instance, why penalize the guy and make him go back and do the same thing again because it went to 32 days? He wanted to run. He couldn't run. So let him run. So I've
seen a similar situation. You know, it's if you have a 4-year-old who is unstarted, they're ineligible without having to work for the vet. So, I mean, literally have seen cases where a horse is entered for December 31st. The race doesn't go. The extra's brought back. Horse is ineligible the next day. It's those type of things I think you're alluding to that it's common sense. You know, the horse was entered as a 3-year-old. The next day he's 1 day over, but he can't enter. Now he's got to work for the vet. You're waiting on the results of that for a couple of weeks, and it's just it's tricky.
So there's another instance of the 4-year-old deal. So this is another thing that was floated out a while ago from our group.
Where we're going, I think this is a great idea.
So we went to run in a 2-year-old race. You have to be 2 years old, not 2 years old January 1st. 2 years old from your foaling date. If you're May 5th, you can't run until May 5th. So why not take that same concept as the for the 4-year-old rule? If it didn't turn 4 until June 5th, that test shouldn't apply until you're 4.
I agree. I think that would eliminate them. I don't know statistically where all that lies in terms of potential fatal breakdowns and all that, but you know, I my guess would be the system you're talking about would be just as effective.
Yeah, and nobody's trying to skirt anything. It's just if it's good for a 2-year-old age, why isn't it good for a 4-year-old age? And the idea being that, yes, okay, they waited till 4 years old for whatever reason. Didn't have to mean the horse was infirm or hurt or anything. It just didn't develop until 4. Sure, you want to get him checked out. That's fine. That's not the problem. But the problem is it's situations like that, Todd, and it's just more paperwork that maybe doesn't need to be done. You know, we reach it's time to take a step back maybe and say, okay, where can we change this? This is not that valid.
And the team, Heisen and Haiwu, have been very cooperative. You know, so for example, some of the improvements we've made, if you go to your portal and you look at your horse roster, it'll show you horses that are eligible to race, horses that are eligible to work but not race, and horses that are... So I was talking to Dr. Durenberger yesterday, and I said, now that we have this new 150-day rule place, can we do something on there where at 120 days, we get a little marker on the portal, you know, next to this horse's name, hey, this horse hasn't run for 120 days. You're 30 days away from...
You get the 140.
Now you get, you know, a yellow flag or whatever. So, hey, you know, it's be on alert that you need to work this horse. You need to submit the 150-day layoff form before you can enter. So, and she said she talked to the IT people, and it was something they could possibly do very easily. So,
well, you're supposed to get a 140-day alert, but I agree she didn't say that.
Well, but from what I understand, they're hoping to get a couple of weeks to process all this, and I think what I found, and probably what they're finding is a lot more horses that are going to fall into this category than you would think. And so
I'll tell you the number when we get off the air.
When they started getting bombarded, you know, at the January or December 5th, when this first was implemented, I think, you know, it set the site back, you know, where it kind of blew up the website and kind of put everything on a little bit of hold.
So what I'm finding, and I've been working with Dr. Durenberger on, when a horse goes on the list, okay, that's fine. I'm hear from trainers that I'm not sure what list they went on, B, how do I get off, right? So, well, he told me this, so we're working on a uniform, basically a form that says, okay, you're on this list, you can't work until this date, and you have to take blood, but spelled out, no question, here you go, and so you know exactly what you have to do to get off and when you can do it. And she said, well, that'd be good, rather than guessing. I have people say, no, I entered my horse, and they said I had to work. Well, the guy didn't. Who's the guy? Well, the vet told me I didn't have to work, and when in fact, you know, who knows where, right or wrong, but there's a misunderstanding. So why don't you just write it down and say, here's exactly what you have to do to get back. And the importance of getting back at the right time is, you know, with the cycle, you enter, and if the race doesn't go, and it doesn't come back for 3 weeks, now you've gone over that period again, and that's where we're talking.
That's where you get a little tricky. Like, let's say you really want to be on top of your business, you're going to fill out this form exactly 30 days before 150, but maybe the horse isn't ready, so now you're going to have to fill it out again. And
yes.
So you want to time it. So hopefully you're doing it 2 weeks out, and you got a little cushion on the other side. And so, yeah, it has the potential to create some double work that we just don't need.
We need to eliminate the redundancy of the paperwork you mentioned. I think that now maybe having you go to the portal, maybe getting trainers used to go to the portal, maybe that will solve that with having more stuff done that way, where it's in there and you just kind of check the box that I did this,
I think that's the one thing they are finding out is that when there are glitches, I think the trainers are relying on the portal quite a bit. And, I mean, that's actually become part of my morning routine, you know, is going on the portal and checking every horse that we're breezing that day is cleared.
Doesn't have the flag.
Yeah.
And I think as an industry on this, and we're trying to get trainers to get used to doing that every day, and maybe, who knows, one day you'll go on there every day and you'll enter your horses there as well. And, you know, check on things, be able to go and go, hey, enter the third race and hit a button. Oh, there's six in there. So you can kind of, you get a head start on what's going on. And you
could,
if the kids' book comes out, you could enter 10 horses when the book comes out and then enter additional as you go. And so this is kind of a lead in to getting the trainers to go to that portal every day and just, you know, get their information. And so, you know, that's probably coming down the road is the, you know.
Yeah, you would think so.
Well, coming down the road are some starters that we got to ask you about before we let you go. Todd Pletcher with us from Symposium. And, of course, he and Bob Baffert today will reprise one of the most popular presentations of the last few years, both Arizona alums. I've got to ask you about Vasimo that's coming up at Gulfstream, particularly because, not just because he's a Nyquist colt, he's out of B Sharp Sonata, who was right. You
got her later in her career. Very high quality filly.
A big 3-year-old Florida seat, right?
Right. Yeah. It's a big, leggy, 2-turn horse, but he's shown some tactical speed in his gate works. I like his outside draw going a 1-turn mile. I'm not sure he's the kind of horse that has to win first time out, but I do think he's capable. We like him, and we're excited to get him started.
It feels like, and this is a Team Penny horse, $120,000, which feels like, as a Keeneland yearling, kind of mid-sale, feels like a potential bargain.
That's what we're hoping for, yeah. We certainly would buy him again for probably more than that.
And I just pulled up B-Sharp Sonata looking at this. Cloverleaf Farm, what...
Yeah, I'm trying to think how all that went down. It's been a while ago, but she was a high quality filly. And did she win the Sunshine Millions? Was that what it was?
She won the Devoted Dale.
Right. Okay.
And she won the Forward Gal on the way to finishing fifth in the. She was second in the Ashland.
Yep.
And fifth in the Kentucky Oaks.
Yeah, she's a good filly, and I think trying to think maybe. Closely related to another filly that's running pretty well right now. Can't call her off the top of my head.
Kieran beat you a neck in the Ashland with Little Bell.
Yeah.
There's a name, my friend.
And what year was that?
That was 2008. And Proud Spell was third. She turns around and wins.
The Oaks, yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Tell us also about, there's another firster, Majorca. This is a volatile out of a Malibu Moon Mare, Harrell and Starlight. I saw Jack here. I saw Jack Wolf yesterday.
Yeah, he's here. It's a nice colt, I think. It's always been a really good moving colt. He, too, has been working well. His last gate work was pretty sharp on Friday. And, you know, gives you the impression he should come out with a solid debut.
I like it. And then there's a filly I want to ask you about that starts this week. This is a homebred, Frank Batten, and a Uncle Mo filly out of the Bernardini mare, Pepe Raffaella. Ruth.
Big scopey Uncle Mo filly. I think she's She's also similar to what we were talking about with Vasimo, is looking for two turns, but works have been good. I could see her, you know, hopefully running well in her debut.
You're also involved. You got the pair of fillies in the Tropical Park Oaks.
Yeah, we're coming back off a bit of a layoff with Life's an Audible, and we're trying to. There was a shorter allowance race that didn't fill, so we ended up here. And Gilded Edge, currently too deep on the AE. I don't know if she's going to get an opportunity or not, but she's kind of surprised us recently with a couple of decent efforts at a big price. So this race in the Tropical Park Derby always come up pretty popular. It's obviously the kind of the last go at straight three-year-olds.
Finally, there's got to be a two-year-old soon to turn three that you're excited about.
I mean, I think two of them are those that we just talked about,
really?
that are in on Saturday, Vasimo and the volatile colt Mallorca. So we're hoping
seventh and the ninth.
Yeah, hoping they'll come out with good debuts and maybe show something. We've been, like I said, a little bit disappointed with the crop. We've got a couple curling colts that are still, you know, getting maybe a month or so away that you know, hopefully could step up, but. Yeah, it's.
Do we have a name on those curling colts?
Well, they're owned by Rapoli, so they'll have a name. Name on entry day.
Very good.
Let me ask you. I want to ask you about one filly, my favorite horse that you trained, Rags to Riches, and I was lucky enough that you were in California that year.
Right.
And we got Bob and Bill. When she broke her maiden at 7/8 that day. In fact, these are the two most impressive maiden breakers. Colt at 7/8. We know. And affiliate at 7/8, Rags to Riches. And that was one of those wow times. And then she went on to do the Oaks and, of course, Glory. Yeah. But she was my favorite horse that you trained. And I was lucky enough to see her those first few times.
Yeah, she was special. Obviously, to beat Curlin in the Belmont was incredible effort, especially after falling on her nose at the start. And
cost you a pair of binoculars.
Yeah. I've politicked for her to get into the Hall of Fame, which
I was going to ask. She's on the doorstep. I don't get that.
Yeah, to me, I mean, you know, the Hall of Fame should be something about, you know, an accomplishment that not many others do. And for her to win the Belmont,
that's only a separator.
Only doing 110 years now or whatever, to me, that kind of stamps your way in. So I'm still hoping maybe the committee will see it that way at some point.
Here we go.
Bob, I'm getting ready to turn this over to you.
There you go.
Todd. Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Balfour.
Yeah, we got that.
Now I
got
to get a picture of the two of you together. All right. Slide together.
This is like the pre-fight that you guys can.
Let me get that background cleared. There we go.
I got to get in one of these.
Of course you do. There we go. All right, that hammer's going to get in. Oh my God, that's true. You're all Arizona grads, so you, I guess you got to lean back in time. Barely. That's great. That was great. All right, there we go. Todd, thanks so much.